Since all of you have quieted down, and we have a few people still getting some refreshments there, please continue and then join us. We should begin. We have an hour, and I think we're going to use that to full advantage. I'm Carl Indefirth. I'm the chair of the U.S.-India program here, the Wadhwani chair, and I'm delighted to have you here this morning to talk about the U.S.-India military engagement report that we will be releasing now. I'm joined by Dr. Amir Latif to my left. You know Amir has been here for the last almost 2 years as a visiting fellow from the Defense Department. Unfortunately, duty calls. Amir will be returning to the Pentagon, and this is his last day here, so it's a bittersweet occasion, both to celebrate the second of the reports that he has done, the earlier one on defense trade, which I'll mention again in a moment, but also this second report on U.S.-India military engagement. And as a special guest speaker, we have Admiral Walter Duran, the former commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet. For those of you who have read our U.S.-India Insight, our monthly publication, which for the month of October, although Hurricane Sandy made us release it in November, you will have seen that there is a sidebar piece talking about the report, a sidebar piece entitled A Tale of Two Admirals, and here is one of the two admirals. More on that later. More on that later. Let me set the stage for this morning's discussion. That we'll have. I might even mention that today's Hindustan Times has already set the stage. They are already running some press coverage with the title, press coverage of this report, the title, Indo-U.S. Military Ties Can Alter World Power Dynamics. I think that's a pretty good start for, we're going to alter world power dynamics with this report, Amir. You've got a heavy burden to bear in that regard. But actually, let me set the stage, and rather than my setting the stage, why don't we have National Security Advisor Tom Donilon, who was in this room last week before he went off to Southeast Asia with President Obama. He was here to speak about the president's trip, and in his remarks, when he was here to talk about the rebalancing to Asia and the components of that, and in that, he talked about India, and he said, and this is his quote, it was in response to a question from the Indonesian ambassador. He said, with respect to India, we have given a full embrace of India's rise. Then he said, it's a full embrace of India's rise as a partner. Well, we've heard a lot of U.S. officials talk. President Obama calls this the defining partnership of the 21st century, one of the defining partnerships. So you continue to hear from the administration, and now most recently, the full embrace quote from Tom Donilon. So that sort of sets the stage here. We have done, as part of that full embrace, it is an embrace across the board of our relations, the economic relationship, the security relationship, defense relationship, people to people. It's a full embrace. And within the context of our defense and security relationship, we have embarked over the past year and a half on a project that includes three components, enhancing U.S.-India defense trade. This report on military engagement, mill to mill, as it's often referred to. And we also have a third component, which is homeland security, which our colleague Ozzie Nelson will be releasing soon on how to increase our homeland security cooperation. So you've seen the report. Hopefully you've gotten this. This is the executive summary. We're going to take several bites at this apple. We've already done our insight, calling attention to it. This is the rollout of the executive summary, summary of conclusions, and then we'll have the full report next month, and you'll all be receiving that. We did have one question about the report's title, U.S.-India Military Engagement. As you'll see, it says, steady as they go. Amir and I had long discussions, and maybe the Admiral can tell us if we got it right. do we say steady as she goes? But we said, but in this case, it's a they because it's U.S. and India. So we actually did it both ways. For the insight, we said steady as she goes. Here we're saying steady as they go. The fact is we are on a good course right now with military engagement. So we should be steady as they, she goes. The question is, where do we take it in the next phase? And that's what we'll be discussing here. So with that, let me do a very important final duty before turning to Amir to discuss the report, its findings, conclusions, and recommendations. Let me introduce our guest speaker, Admiral Duran. Commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet from 2002 to 2005. Now, for those of you who are not aware of this, most of you, I think, here are, but this is the world's largest combined fleet command, more than 180 ships, 1,400 aircraft, 150,000 sailors, Marines, and civilians. This is a big command. He also served as an assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was commander of the U.S. 7th Fleet, based in Japan. He was deputy commander of the U.S. Southern Command. How much more experience can you look for in a guest speaker? We're delighted to have the Admiral here. He also got his bachelor's degree from Villanova. He's got a master's degree from the University of Oklahoma. And most importantly, and you'll understand more about this, he also received a master's degree in defense studies from the India Defense Services Staff College in Wellington, India, in 1979. So that is a part of that tale of two admirals, which he will further explain. Since leaving the Navy, he has been with Raytheon. He was in Singapore for several years, continues to serve as a consultant there. So all kinds of great experience that add up to what we'll hear from Admiral Duran. So with that as a scene setter, let me turn to my colleague Amir Latif to discuss his latest report. Amir?
Okay, well, thank you very much, Rick, for that introduction, and thanks to all of you for being here today. The wonderful turnout that we have here, I think, is indicative of the interest that all of you have in this particular topic. I'd like to thank a couple of people before we get started, but before I do that, let me also just kind of utter the standard disclaimer that let me say that anything that I express here today are my own comments and views and don't represent those of CSIS, the Defense Department of the U.S. government. So before I get going on really outlining the findings of the report, let me just say a very hearty thank you to Admiral Doran for joining us here today from Williamsburg. The Admiral has been an individual who has had a very close and an intimate contact with India going back to his junior days as a naval officer. And has also continued that experience with India in his corporate hat as well with Raytheon. So I'm very much happy to have him here today to really kind of provide an added perspective on this relationship because he's done quite a bit to enhance it in his various capacities. And secondly, I'd like to thank Rick Inderfirth for all of the encouragement and guidance that he provided for the project. Rick and I actually showed up here at the same time in January of 2011 and stood up this program together. But it's with his leadership and his vision that I think that the Wadhwani Chair in U.S.-India Policy Studies has gotten to a point where it is today, which is, I think, one of the best India-focused programs in the Washington think tank community. So, Rick, thank you for all you've done to help really promote this program. Now, before I get into the findings of the report, I think it's important for us to really kind of talk a little bit about some of the context in which we are discussing U.S.-India military engagement. I think just a cursory check of the front page of the Washington Post today, we all know that the president is on his swing through Asia. He just finished up is in the midst of a historic trip to Burma. He's also going to be visiting Cambodia and Thailand as well. About a week ago, we had Secretary Panetta and Secretary Clinton on their way to Australia, as well as then crisscrossing Asia. And then this was then preceded, I think, about a couple of months back, where Secretary Panetta and well, Secretary Ash Carter went to India in May and June. And so the release of this report, I think, comes at a very interesting time in the rebalancing to Asia. So if we look at how the Obama administration has been approaching it, they've really made a full court press to communicate to the region that the United States is going to be really focused on Asia for the coming decades in this century. And to echo what Rick said about National Security Advisor Donilon's speech that was made in this room here about a week ago, he did make the comment about embracing India, but there was another quote in there that I thought was quite notable, and I'd like to bring it to your attention. You know, one of the things that Mr. Donilon did was that he outlined kind of a five lines of effort approach to Asia. And the second line of effort in that particular approach was really deepening emerging partnerships with countries such as India and Indonesia. And, you know, the way he characterized these partnerships, he said, look, we approached it by trying to think, and this is his quote, trying to think 10 and 20 years out, what do these partnerships look like? And I think that that is really kind of the frame of reference which we need to look at when we're talking about U.S.-India defense ties, is to really take a very large frame of reference and to really kind of look to the long term about how we actually deepen these partnerships. He went on to say that we see India as a strategic partner for the 21st century, and as such, we welcome India's efforts to look east and play a larger role in Asia, to including in the Indian Ocean. Now, taking that as kind of background, we come to the issue of U.S.-India defense cooperation or military engagement. And as I mentioned earlier, Secretary Panetta and Deputy Secretary Carter have been keenly interested in deepening this relationship. So, you know, the relationship has made some very notable progress over the past decade. I mean, I think that we are now at a point where, in an off-sited talking point, the U.S. and India now, you know, conduct, or India now conducts more exercises with the United States than with any other country. And that the level of military engagement is growing in size, scope, and sophistication, and is getting better and better every year. But I think that, you know, we have now come to a point in the relationship where we need to think about where we want to take military ties between the two countries. I think what you have right now is a relationship in which the militaries both have a good respect, a very healthy respect for one another, a deepening respect. There is a growing exchange of experiences, growing military-to-military contact, growing numbers of VIP visits. But I think what we need to do is to really think about, okay, how can we take this relationship of military engagement, which has been quite good, but it's been largely in the realm of being exercise-based, and see if we can perhaps transition it to being a relationship in which we can perhaps cooperate on areas of operational concern and significance. Now, the 2004 tsunami, which was alluded to earlier, I think is one of the significant incidents or events in the life of the U.S.-India military-to-military relationship. So the question now becomes is that can we now take this relationship and make it to where the U.S. and India routinely and consistently operate together on areas of mutual strategic concern? Now, in the process of researching this question, what we did was, you know, in terms of just a little bit of methodology discussion, is to really kind of look at all areas of bilateral service cooperation. So usually when people think about U.S.-India defense cooperation, the first thing that they think about is naval or maritime cooperation. And I think that even to the casual observer, it's evident as to why U.S.-India or bilateral naval cooperation is important. The common concerns of piracy, proliferation, the security of sea lines of communication. I mean, all of those areas are areas that, you know, are of common concern to both U.S. and India. But I think that when you look at some of the other areas of military cooperation, the strategic underpinnings of the relationship are a little bit more nebulous. So when you look at Air Force cooperation, what is really the basis for the strategic underpinnings of Air Force cooperation? There's a lot of good military-to-military engagement between the two sides. People-to-people contacts are deepening. But what are the sorts of operational scenarios where we can see the Air Forces cooperating together? And also with the armies. The army-to-army engagement has been quite successful. The people-to-people contacts have been very good. There's a respect that's been developing between the two sides. But again, what does the engagement between the two armies ultimately lead to, and what are the sorts of operational scenarios where we might envision it? So what we tried to do is to take a look at some of these areas to see where we perhaps might be able to deepen cooperation, not just in the naval realm, but also perhaps in the air and ground realm as well. Now, what I'll do is just in this short time that I have is really kind of outline some of the key findings. I want to talk a little bit about some of the challenges and some of the key recommendations that we had. But before we do that, I'll just also just mention one caveat with this report. As we all know, for all of you that are keen India watchers, the Indians are very, very interested in technology acquisition and technology procurement. I just want to say that in this report, we did not discuss issues of tech transfer, co-production, or co-development or offsets. And the reason we didn't do that is really specifically because, number one, we've already dealt with those issues in great depth in our first report on U.S.-India defense trade. So we wanted to really kind of focus on just really looking at the interaction between the two militaries and how we deepen those. So for those that are interested in those issues, I would refer you to the report that we've got, and then you can also get it on the CSIS website. Now, let me just very briefly kind of outline some of the kind of key findings. There's a number of findings in the report, but these are just kind of some of the more significant ones that I just kind of wanted to bring to your attention. First of all, I think it's important to realize that both sides have different visions for what they want out of the military engagement. There are different objectives that both sides have. And so when you look at the U.S., they have a much more expansive vision for what they want to achieve out of the military engagement relationship, a relationship in which the U.S. and India can work on areas of common strategic concern, to be a routine and consistent partner, to use some of the phrases that have been uttered in official U.S. government documents, to be that net provider of security, or to perhaps be that linchpin. I think from the Indian perspective, the view is perhaps a little bit more limited. And so I think that the first finding that we need to be really kind of conscious of is the fact that the differing objectives that both sides have for this relationship, I think, could naturally lead to kind of an inherent limitation of how far we can go with this relationship in the near to midterm, which I define as the next kind of 5 to 10 years. Second finding is that I think that, you know, with all the talk about India as a potential provider of security and being able to be a critical element of security and stability, I think that going back to Mr. Donilon's comments from last week, we need to really take a long-term view on when that is going to happen, because from the research that we did for the report, our conclusion is that India is not going to be a decisive provider of security in the Indian Ocean region for the next 5 to 10 years, only because it's still very much in an evolutionary phase of developing its military, modernizing its military, and actually coming to grips with how to employ that military for the achievement of their own national security interests. The third finding is that the civilian bureaucracy within the Ministry of Defense, we found, is a significant impediment to closer U.S.-India military ties. Now, I hear some chuckles around the room, and I think to any veteran India watcher, that's not a new finding. But I think it bears mentioning here. You know, in our research, we consistently found that when you talk to the services, when you talk to folks in the Army, the Navy, the Air Force from both sides, there is a hunger, there is a great desire to see closer service-to-service relations. But unfortunately, of course, the civilian overseers within the Indian bureaucracy have some reservations. And a lot of those are reservations that, you know, obviously go beyond just the desire to engage. I mean, they've got a number of factors to consider. And so I'm not saying that those are factors that shouldn't be considered legitimate, but they are factors that the MOD takes into account as it limits partnership or deepening partnership with the U.S. Number four, I would offer to you that the overall service cooperation between the two sides needs to be anchored to some sort of a more clear strategic end state, as I referenced earlier. I think that the Air Force, the Navy, and the Army need to develop some sort of strategic end states of where they want to take their relationship and how to focus their engagement. I think that the new framework signed in 2005 was a very good start, but that we need to take it to the next level now. And then finally, I would say that the threat perceptions between the both sides can also be different and also inherently limit cooperation. And so when you talk to the Indian side and the U.S. side and you talk about strategic convergence, I think in a general sense, yes, there is strategic convergence of interests, but there are times when there are certain issues and threats that come up where both sides may have differing perceptions about the urgency, the magnitude, and the complexity of various threats. And that can also be a limiting factor. So with that said, let me just talk a little bit about the challenges that I see as inherent to the partnership. And we in the report actually identified four challenges. Strategic challenges, bureaucratic challenges, policy and political challenges, and the final were capacity challenges. And just very quickly, I'll go through on strategic. You know, when we're talking about strategic challenges, in the report, we did not distinguish between the four categories of challenges in terms of whether one is more important than the other. But the strategic challenge, I think, or basket of challenges, I think could serve as kind of a chapeau because if you're not strategically aligned, you're not going to be able to really kind of address effectively perhaps some of the other challenges. But in this regard, when I'm talking about strategic challenges, I'm talking about really kind of three sub-baskets of issues. Number one, kind of the lack of a common vision, which I've already talked about. Number two, the need to better define terms. And in this regard, I'm talking about perhaps concepts such as interoperability. How can the U.S. and India work together to define a better concept of interoperability, one in which India is more comfortable with the terminology that's being used, yet also fulfills the purpose of being able to have more of a cooperative relationship? For those of you that may not know, interoperability tends to be a little bit of a bugaboo term for the Indian side because it kind of connotes a bit of a semi or quasi alliance. So can we get beyond the terms or define the terms a little bit more with a little bit more scalability to where we can have a bit much more productive discussion about working towards more practical cooperation? And then thirdly, I think managing expectations in the strategic realm. Where the United States feels that it can never go fast enough, I think that from the Indian side, they've been going quite quickly and have actually been doing quite well. So there's differing perceptions about how much progress is being made in the relationship, and I think that those expectations on both sides need to be calibrated. From the Indian side, of course, they're never satisfied enough with the amount of tech transfer that they're getting. And so that those, you know, expectations need to be calibrated a little bit. So managing expectations is kind of the third sub-basket. On bureaucratic challenges, very quickly, I will say that, you know, there's a number of dimensions to the Indian bureaucracy, as well as the American bureaucracy, that can hinder cooperation. On the Indian side, just very quickly, I'll mention that, you know, a lot of the impediments can be rooted in perhaps sometimes a lack of bureaucratic capacity on the Indian side, combined with sometimes a little bit of a lack of expertise on security matters. As we all know, with the Indian Administrative Service dealing with a very generalist sort of service, you'll get individuals into the Ministry of Defense who may not be very knowledgeable about security issues. And so it becomes a bit difficult to sometimes have a very deep strategic discussion between both sides within the defense establishments. On the U.S. side, of course, the tech transfer issues, which I alluded to and we've talked about in great depth in a prior report. But there's also been, from time to time, concern on the Indian side about combatant command seam issues. And I'll defer to Admiral Dorn on to talk about those issues. But, you know, those, I'll just say, is that, you know, in our investigation of combatant command issues, I mean, what we found was is that over time, India has become a little bit more used to working with the combatant command structure within the United States. But, again, there are, from time to time, some hiccups, and I'm going to allow the Admiral to look at those. Now, on policy and political challenges, the third category of challenges, I think we also have under here four subcategories. And the first is, of course, the U.S.-Pakistan relationship as it affects India ties. So it's no secret in this room that, of course, the Indians are very concerned about the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. And I think that over time, India has increasingly understood why the United States and how the United States engages with Pakistan, but I don't think they like it any better. And so, you know, I think that there is still an element of doubt in the minds of many Indian policymakers as to how much importance American policymakers perhaps accord Indian concerns about perhaps U.S. weapon sales to Pakistan and the way that the United States engages the Pakistanis. Secondly, on defense agreements, I think that this is a very well-worn topic. I will just very briefly say that in the report, we have made the recommendation that the United States should just really refrain from emphasizing these agreements. Given the fact that the Indians have got some concerns about interoperability, it makes little sense to press agreements to really kind of foist a concept on India for which it's not ready. Domestic political considerations, I think, are the other element here. And we've talked about it in some depth in the report. One of the things that we found is that, of course, you know, with the political sensitivities that exist within India, within the leftists, among leftist politicians, I think that there is always a bit of inherent caution that exists within the Indian policymaking structure to advance ties. I think what's going to be interesting is that as we move towards 2014 and we see the growing influence of state parties or state-based parties, how will that change the complexion of U.S.-India defense ties in the future? I think that that remains to be seen. And then, of course, the lingering trust deficit, which I think harkens back to India's memory of sanctions being imposed not just in the 1960s and during the Cold War, but even as recently as 1998 after the nuclear tests. The final category is capacity challenges. And what I'm talking about here is not bureaucratic capacity, but just military capacity. The Indian military is a military which is occupied in a variety of different contingencies, both internal to India as well as externally. It is in the process of modernizing what is an increasingly antiquated military force. And it's also contending with a number of personnel challenges as well. With some recent reports of mutinies in the ranks within the Army, as well as some other corruption scandals that have also erupted, I think that, you know, you've got the Army service leadership, which has increasingly become internally focused over the past year or so, trying to focus on really improving and fixing some of the internal problems that exist within the services. So that combination of modernization, of personnel challenges, as well as just a very complex security environment, I think all conspire to really make capacity a key issue in moving the relationship forward. Now, let me just turn very quickly to the recommendations section, and then I'll just end up here. I think that in the report, we've got 30 recommendations. We've got them in a general category, which is recommendations to both sides, as well as to the Indian side, as well as to the U.S. side. But just four or five that I'll quickly highlight to you. First of all, I think that both sides need to really kind of commit on one or two operational areas for future cooperation. So in the report, we recommend disaster response as really one area where perhaps maybe the U.S. and India can go forward and develop tactics, techniques, and procedures and communication protocols on how they will address a disaster, perhaps on the scale of the tsunami or even something on the scale of a cyclone sitter. So doing that, I think, would really be an excellent way to develop habits of cooperation in the operational realm and really also kind of start to move the relationship to a more operationally based relationship. Secondly, I think that the services, the individual services in their bilateral dialogues, need to start engaging in more strategic discussions about security threats and stability issues in the Asia Pacific. I think when you look at the executive steering groups, which are the bilateral groupings where the U.S. and India have their individual service discussions, perhaps there isn't as much discussion about strategic issues such as the rise of China's military and what it means for stability and stability in the Asia Pacific, or perhaps stability in Afghanistan. So to be able to have some of those more strategic discussions at a service-to-service level, I think would be very helpful. Thirdly, I think that there needs to be more work towards instituting more of a joint approach across the exercises. Right now, we have a very compartmentalized approach to our exercises, perhaps maybe trying to move towards a more joint sort of a construct where the U.S. and India can exercise across various services in a joint fashion would be helpful. Fourth, we have put in a recommendation to the Indian side to perhaps maybe within the Ministry of Defense think about establishing an office or an official that deals with policy and strategy, and put that individual at the additional secretary level, somebody that is knowledgeable about security issues that can perhaps also have good strategic discussions about where to take the relationship in the future, I think could be a very helpful idea. Fifthly, I think that the multilateral activities, which have gained a lot of note with the U.S., India, and Japan maritime exercises, I think should continue. They ought to be intensified. I think that in the Indian context, of course, there's been some sensitivity of engaging in multilateral activities because of perhaps some concerns that Beijing might have about perhaps some sort of a counter-China strategy emerging. But be that as it may, I think that, you know, having the multilateral engagements develops habits of cooperation among some of Asia's powers, which I think is a very important thing. And then finally, I think that, you know, despite the fact that we're talking about U.S.-India military engagement here, I think that there is also a case to be made to encourage India to lead on its own, to lead engagements in the Indo-Pacific without U.S. involvement. I think sometimes perhaps too much insistence on having bilateral engagements with India perhaps maybe takes away something from the benefit of perhaps having the Indian military lead on exercises like it does with the Milan exercises in the Bay of Bengal. There's something to be said for that. So to wrap all this up, let me just kind of circle back to really kind of what's at stake here and why all of this is important. As the United States rebalances to Asia, India and the United States, I think, are increasingly going to face areas of common concern and strategic threats that range from natural disasters to terrorism to proliferation, as well as a rising China whose strategic aims, I think, are still rather nebulous. So faced with these prospects, I think that there's a great opportunity here for both of these countries to really kind of take the current trajectory of their relationship and their ties and deepen them even further. Because to do so, I think, will work towards making the region not only secure for each other, but also the larger Indo-Pacific as well. So let me just end it on that note, and I look forward to your questions in the Q&A.
Great. Wonderful, Amir. Very comprehensive. And I think it set the stage now to hear from Admiral Doran about his reaction to summary of conclusions and recommendations. And perhaps he can tell us a little bit more about the tale of two admirals. Admiral,
well,
thank you.
Thank you very much. Ambassador Indefirth, Dr. Lateef, CSIS, and everyone in attendance today, it really is a great pleasure and an honor to be called off the golf courses of Williamsburg to come back up and talk about something that's been near and dear to my heart for a long time. This really is, I think everybody in the room will understand and agree that this really is a very important issue at a very important time that we're discussing. It has to be, it should be talked about now, lest it succumb to the fatigue and the frustration that to a certain degree is flowing around the overall relationship over the results of the inertia of the last decade. It's important that we remember how far we've come and how quickly we've come and not forget the progress that we've made. I think the idea of reigniting the U.S.-India relationship is said perfectly, and I think the military-to-military relationships are a perfect place to start to reignite that relationship. But let me start my comments this morning and take you back to a time when the relationships were not quite as mature and tell you a little bit of my own story and a little bit about the tale of two admirals, which I was very surprised to see in print when it came out in the newsletter. But it's nice to know that somebody still remembers and that these things are being talked about and thought about. Little did I realize on Christmas Eve of 1978, when I put my wife, my two boys, and my small dog onto a Pan Am flight and set off for the Nilgiri Mountains in South India, that I would be standing here some 34 years, almost exactly 34 years later, discussing and talking about some of the relationships that flowed out of that remarkable year down in the Nilgiris, down in Tamil Nadu. I hope after we get through with our discussion, you'll feel that my relationships kind of reflect the importance of the informal relationships that can be developed between military officers at a very young age that then can be matured over the length of a career and on occasion will have great significance when those officers come into position of important commands or major commands. Also, in my case, it never ceases to amaze me the curious manner in which my relationship with India focused and also shaped the rest of my 38-year Navy career. I'm sure that nobody in the Bureau of Naval Personnel, when they put my family on that plane to India, did that with the expectation that I would be the Pacific Fleet Commander some 30 years later. But it did work out that way, and I was continuously drawn back to India throughout my career. So what I'm talking to you about today is something that I feel very strongly, very personally about, and I think it is desperately important for both our nations to think ourselves through this. When my family and I arrived in the Wellington Cantonment outside of Kannur, down in Tamil Nadu, we found ourselves surrounded and amidst a group of really remarkable young military officers, both Indians, and there was a mix of international officers down there also with which we would interface throughout our year at Wellington. Inside the Naval Syndicate, amongst my colleagues were Arun Prakash and Suresh Mehta, both of whom went on to be Chiefs of Naval Staff, and of course Barry Barathon, who went on to be the Vice Chief of Navy Staff for Arun and served as the attaché for the Indian Navy here in Washington. There were also, of course, a number of very important, prominent, and significant officers from the Indian Air Force, the Indian Army, including at least one Chief of Staff of the Indian Army with whom we were classmates and colleagues during our year in Tamil Nadu. During that year, 1979, think back to 1979. 1979 was not a quiet year. There was a lot going on in 1979, and I was getting my information and discussing things through the prism of the Defense Services Staff College and the people with whom I was going to class with and socializing with down in Tamil Nadu. During that year, if you just think back on a few major milestones that occurred, the Shah fell, Bhutto was hung, the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad was attacked and burned, and all of this was discussed both inside the classroom and outside the classroom. One of the most important parts of these relationships, these military-to-military relationships, particularly with young officers who are in their formative years, is that for not only myself, but for my children and my wife, my family in total, there was as much education that went on outside the classroom as went on inside the classroom. And I have carried it with me to this day, and it's been very, very important to me. After leaving Wellington, of course, I came back to the United States and went to sea, and we all went our various ways. But the Prakashes, the Mehtas, the Barathons, and the Dorans were a group of eight that really did hang around together. We socialized together, and we formed a very close, familiar bond between ourselves and our families that continued after we left the Nilgiri Mountains. We kept contact as we could, and of course, as you can imagine, especially when we were younger, it wasn't all that often or regular, but when we could, we did, certainly by correspondence. But both Admiral Prakash and Admiral Barathon came to the United States Naval War College in Newport. Jenny and I were able to see them and their wives, Rena and Kumkum, while they were there and to rekindle the relationship. Admiral Barathon, of course, came back in 1993 as the Indian Naval Attaché to Washington. That coincidentally happened to be the year that I returned to Washington as a new one-star officer, and so Barry and I were able to reacquaint ourselves with our relationship, and our families, again, maintained our bond. When I went on to be the commander of Task Force 76, living in Okinawa, Japan, I was able to visit India, and then as the commander of the United States 7th Fleet, we restarted the Malabar series of exercise between the United States and India, and I again went back to India, and on each of these occasions, I was able to visit with Admiral Barathon, Admiral Prakash, and Admiral Mehta. So these relationships did maintain themselves, and they were built upon real friendship and real trust. These relationships were valued, and they were treasured personally throughout the years, but they took on a different significance, a greater significance when I assumed the position as the Pacific Fleet Commander. Shortly after I took over in 2002 as the commander of the United States Pacific Fleet, Arun Prakash was named as the Chief of Naval Staff in New Delhi. Admiral Mehta at the time was in command of a fleet, and Admiral Barathon at the time was the Chief of Personnel, Naval Personnel, and as I said, stepped up to be the Vice Chief under Admiral Prakash. So these were all very important relationships between men who had known each other at that point for about 30 years. That set the stage for the tsunami which hit Southeast Asia in December of 2004, and you all remember that. The epicenter was right off Banda Aceh, Indonesia. And we were all scrambling. It occurred over Christmas. So a lot of the bureaucracies, a lot of the policy folks were understandably and naturally on Christmas Eve. The Pentagon was slightly empty, not always a bad thing, but it was slightly empty as we started to react to what was going on in the tsunami. The Pacific Fleet we sent to react to the tsunami, we sent the Abraham Lincoln Battle Group, which I had had in port in Hong Kong over the holidays, with the strike wing on board. I also turned the Bonhomme Richard Expeditionary Strike Group, which was in the waters off Guam, the Northern Marianas. And the Bonhomme Richard Expeditionary Strike Group had about between 1,400 and 1,500 Marines on board. And they were on their way to the Gulf to be the strategic reserve for John Abizaid during the war in the Gulf. So this was a credible combat force that was now streaming very quickly at best speed towards the Indian Ocean. We were all very aware as this developed that there was no command apparatus that we were working under and that there would not be a command apparatus. This truly was a coalition of willing maritime nations reacting to this. Now, I'll refer in my comments to this being a maritime disaster and a maritime reaction, but let's not lose sight of the fact that there were tremendous contributions by the United States Air Force and by air forces from other nations that were involved. But primarily, it was a maritime theater, and it was a maritime disaster that we're responding to. And we had a lot of navies moving around in those waters. And we had this very formidable force moving into the Indian Ocean. So with the concurrence of Admiral Clark, who was the Chief of Naval Operations, and of Tom Fargo, who was the Pacific Commander, who had appointed me as the executive agent for this relief effort, I called Arun Prakash, Admiral Prakash, in Delhi, and I explained to him who we were moving, what forces we were moving into the Indian Ocean, and in rough terms, where we were going to go, that we were going to range from the area off Banda Aceh up towards the west coast of Thailand, up towards Phuket, all the way over to the Maldives, and that I did not want anybody in India to be concerned about this force that was now moving into the waters closer to India. I didn't want them to be concerned. I didn't want anybody to overreact. And I also did not want us stepping on each other. I wondered if there was a way that we could have an informal regime where we could provide the best amount of relief with the resources we had to the people who sorely needed them. And so what came out of that was a degree of cooperation between our navies primarily, but between our militaries also from with Arun's help in Delhi, but primarily between our navies, that happened immediately and continued on through the time of the crisis period. And I would offer to you that if our two governments had decided to sit down and do this, it would have been difficult, and it would have taken a much longer period of time to work out the protocols, the tactics, techniques, and procedures, and how we were going to get ourselves around this. To a large degree, and I really don't want to overplay this, but to a large degree, this was done because of the trust that was built up between Admiral Prakash and myself, and the fact that we had known each other for over 30 years, and that we could talk to each other. And in this case, it worked. And it was a wonderful example of what can come out of these relationships and this strange set of orders that comes to a lieutenant commander sitting in the Pentagon in October, telling him to be in Tamil Nadu. Actually, when they called me the first time, they said, "Do you want to go to Wellington?" And I thought, New Zealand, not too bad. And then the rest of the story unfolded. But it was a career-changing and in many ways a life-changing set of orders for myself. While I'm at the dais, however, I'd also just like to applaud and endorse the set of recommendations that have been put forth in this study, which I had a chance to review before coming down here this morning. And although no set of recommendations, especially a set of recommendations on such a complicated and complex subject, can expect it to be perfect, these are an excellent place for us to start to ensure that we maintain the inertia that has been set up over the last decade or so in this relationship. And again, the term to reignite the relationship between India and the United States is about perfect. And I think the military-to-military relationship is a good place to start because there is a natural, I think particularly in the maritime sphere, a natural understanding between these two bodies. There are, of course, difficulties on both sides that we'll need to be overcome. In addition to the progress we have made, there is still an incredible amount of baggage on both sides that'll have to be addressed. And Dr. Lateef mentioned a few of the major issues there. The study makes notion of some of them, such as the misinterpretation or misunderstanding of certain terms, where terms or words mean different things to different groups. One of those is interoperability. Okay, the fact of what interoperability may mean to United States naval officer or military officer can mean something very different in an Indian context, and particularly when it gets to the policy side. The relationship between the United States and Pakistan will be there and will always be a certain amount of an irritant in any of these discussions, and we need to come to grips with that and deal with it. And the bureaucratic hurdles that are entrenched in both sides. The combatant command piece was an interesting one because it does come up, and I understand it. India has a natural inclination because of the amount of Indian citizens that live in the Gulf area to look that way. They also are aware that their oil comes out of the Gulf. They are aware the sea lanes of communication and commerce that come through their area all flow out of the Gulf. And there is a natural inclination to kind of question why they are not in CENTCOM and to kind of say, shouldn't we be in CENTCOM rather than being in PACOM? I think they're coming to understand this better, and I think PACOM is the right place for the Indian relationship to be. If they were, CENTCOM, quite frankly, is exhausted and consumed with other issues. And India is, in and of itself, an important issue. I don't mean that PACOM doesn't have other issues. They do. China's a fairly good-sized issue. But I think India fits very nicely into the PACOM scheme and the PACOM view of the world view. And I think it would be a mistake if India got into CENTCOM. And again, of course, then you would have a direct up against Pakistan, who is who does play in the CENTCOM arena. I think the Indians understand that much better now. The relationship is important to both sides, and this is a great time to continue to start to work on it, to reignite it. The U.S.-India relationship is going to be a generational issue, and we all need to understand that. And as Americans, that's kind of a difficult pill for us to swallow. We tend to want to move very quickly. Our businesses report to Wall Street every quarter, our publicly traded businesses. We have an election every 4 years. We tend to want to see immediate results, return on invested capital. It's the terms within which we look at things. This will not develop that way. This is going to be a generational issue, but it is worth a generation of work. India, quite frankly, for the United States, from a very selfish point of view, India is too important and will continue to be too important to either be ignored, put on the back burner, or to be allowed to succumb to this feeling of fatigue to a certain degree that has come over the discussions right now. So I want to thank everybody for having me. It's a great pleasure to be pulled out of the barn and brought back onto the dais. And I really do think that this is a very important study, and thank you both very much. And I'd be prepared to take any questions from anybody. Thank you.
We've got about 10 or 15 minutes for questions. Admiral Duran and myself had a good discussion before we came down here, and he certainly has that overall perspective of where our relations have come, broadly speaking, as well as in terms of our defense and military ties. We did talk about what has occurred in the last decade plus, the momentum that has built up here. We were talking actually upstairs about that inertia which defined the relationship before 2000 and how during the last 10, 12 years under three presidents, Democratic and Republican, we've seen this great increase. And I must say, as one who worked under President Clinton, the real defining moment for moving ahead on the military and defense side came under President George W. Bush. That's when we got off in a new direction, both on defense trade and the 2005 new framework agreement. Trade started to pick up. Now defense trade is approaching $10 billion, and Ambassador Nancy Powell says another 6 to 8 is in the pipeline, and especially what we're talking about today on military engagement, which did take place, and quite frankly, when the historians look back a few years from now, I think that what the Admiral referred to in terms of that cooperation for the 2004 tsunami will be a defining moment. That will capture the attention and the vision of where we would like to have that kind of cooperation go forward in the future. So with those comments, let's take some questions. And what I'd like to do is to ask you, I think, do we have mics as well? Great, mics are here. If you could introduce yourself, affiliation, and then fire away. And Wolf, I just saw you right here. So I'll start with
Wolf Gross, now an independent consultant, but still associated very much with the Indian scheme of things. My question goes to the comment that Amer made about the residual concern about the relationships with Pakistan. I have heard from a number of my Indian contacts, some of whom are the same ones that Admiral Doran has, a concern that 2014 is going to be a very pivotal year, and the concern is that the U.S. moves out of the area and essentially dumps PACAF or AFPAC, whatever you want to call it, into the laps of the government of India and to the Indian military. And I wondered whether your study picked this up, and if so, what is a long-term concern, what reactions you have.
Wolf, thanks for the question. We touched on the Afghanistan issue only insofar as the section on threat perceptions. We didn't go into too great depth about it, but you are correct. India has significant concerns about, you know, once the United States, in their perception, leaves in 2014 and is gone, what are they going to be left with? One of the things that we did discuss in the report were ways that perhaps maybe the U.S. and India might be able to work together on stability and security in Afghanistan. And one of the areas that has been kind of ongoing at a bit of a low level, but you know, perhaps maybe could be perhaps amplified, is you know, India has been engaged in the training of some police and security forces within India. And so, you know, we talk a little bit about this. You know, when I talked with Army officers, they were Indian Army officers. They were very enthusiastic about this idea of perhaps maybe having you know, India perhaps do more training of Afghan national security forces within India. Now, of course, as you would know, you know, that's going to raise some sensitivities with our friends in Islamabad. And so how to kind of, you know, circle the square the circle, as the case might be. So you know, it is an idea. The other possibility, which we didn't really discuss, but, you know, are there ways to foster perhaps Indo-Pak cooperation within Afghanistan on economic projects? I mean, that's another kind of idea that's been kind of floated out there. We didn't discuss it in the report, but it's certainly a way to kind of foster some productive activity between the two sides and build confidence.
Mike Macedic with the PBS Online NewsHour. One of the issues you mentioned where we are not necessarily on the same page is Iran. Can the various projects and goals that you outlined in this report withstand a sustained U.S. military attack on Iran, which is a possibility in the coming year?
Let me just say that I think that the United States and India are very clear in their recognition of what is at stake with Iran in terms of its acquiring a nuclear weapons capability. And there is no talk that I'm aware of in terms of any military cooperation there, but what they are trying to do is the two countries are working on diplomatic cooperation, and they're also working on the whole question of how to keep to work to encourage Iran to respond constructively to the international community's concerns. And India has voted with the United States and the IAEA when votes have come up on this question. India has also been reducing its oil dependency, if you will, on Iran, as has other countries. But I think that that's probably where we ought to leave that discussion. But let's turn to the more direct issues of military engagement in the present circumstances. This young woman here in the front row, and then we're going to move sort of back.
Nilanthi Samaranaika, CNA. Amir, great remarks. I have a question for the Admiral. Just to pick up on something you said about, if the two governments had decided to do this, it would have been a difficult process in conducting disaster relief. I wanted to just think in the future about the next great disaster like yeah. the tsunami. Of course, personal relationships hopefully, will accelerate and facilitate that kind of U.S.-India coordination in providing disaster relief. But in the absence of that, how do you envision that kind of coordination occurring? Have there been more advances structurally, institutionally, in terms of bringing that up?
If you go back and think about what happened and when it happened in 2004, 2005, there's nothing good about the tsunami, but one of the fortunate aspects of it happening where it did was that from an American perspective, it all happened in the PACOM AOR. Okay, so Tom Fargo, and with his authority as the PACOM commander, I did not need any other authorities back in Washington to move forces within the AOR. So, under that umbrella and with the concurrence with Tom knowing and Admiral Clark knowing what I was doing, I could move the Abraham Lincoln Battle Group, I could move the Expeditionary Strike Group very, very quickly. Arun was, I think, in a similar situation in reacting to what was going on the coast of India down in Sri Lanka, and they actually did come over to Indonesia, as you know. My only point being is that if we had to set up a committee or a study or decide what was the chain of command going to be between the two navies or who was going to report to whom or any of those pieces, it might have happened, but it wouldn't have happened as immediately as it did. We were flying into and over Banda Aceh on the 1st or 2nd of January on an occurrence that occurred the 24th or 25th of December, depending upon which side of the dateline you were on. So it just happened very quickly and very easily, built on the trust. Now, since that time, there have been some things that have occurred. Okay, as you know, India is very active in the Western Pacific Naval Symposium, where the United States sits. That is a good thing. India also hosts an Indian Ocean Navy Chief organization that the United States has had. I don't think the United States Navy is invited to it. We have sat at it, and we have had a. Are we now invited, Kelly?
Now we're an observer.
Yeah, we're an observer. That's what I meant. We were an observer at it. And the Malabar series of exercises, when Suresh Mehta was the Chief of Navy Staff, if you remember, actually stepped up to a five-nation exercise. Okay, that occurred in the Indian Ocean, and that was an exercise where the invitations came out from the Indian Navy. Okay, and the United States Navy participated in it. But these are all, kind of small steps because of the larger issues that are over us, that because we are both democracies with civilian control of our military, as it should be, that have to be worked out at policy levels. But it is the right time to be thinking of exactly these things, however. So, yep. Good question.
If I could just add one thing to that, just on the personal relationships, one of the things that I found as I was researching this is, Indian officers are taking advantage of a lot of the IMET or International Military and Education sorts of opportunities. They go to the Asia Pacific Center for Strategic Studies in Honolulu, as well as come to the NISA Center here. So India is clearly engaging and taking advantage of the resources. The problem comes in is that after those training opportunities and those relationships have been established between U.S. and Indian officers, and everyone kind of goes their separate ways of maintaining that contact. And I think that there are some restrictions that the Indian side has imposed on a lot of their officers to continue that sort of relationship building. So Admiral Dorn obviously has had a wonderful experience in building that relationship with Admiral Prakash. How can we foster that and really kind of multiply that to where, we have, 10 or 15 lieutenant commanders who encounter their Indian counterparts and to continue that relationship throughout their careers. And that is not happening right now. And I think that's where, we need to really kind of allow the Indians to maintain contact over email and Facebook and all this other sort of stuff. And there's been some sensitivities on the Indian side of security, but again, it helps to build the relationship a bit more.
Thank you very much. Don Klein from Elbit Systems America. I worked at Paycom from 2000 to 2003. Two very brief questions. One for Admiral Dorn. Do you think that the Strait of Malacca transit missions that the Indian Navy performed in 2002 are a good kernel for maybe future kind of ad hoc cooperation? And then for Dr. Lateef, you mentioned the Army, Navy, and Air Force in exercises, but there really might be another component there with special operations, really as almost not as a service, but as a separate type, particularly in light of the Mumbai attack, and there definitely might be some vehicles for operational and exercise cooperation there.
Thank you. This is Lalit Jha from Press Trust of India. Have you shared this report with the Indian and the U.S. governments, and what are the chances that any of these recommendations are being implemented by these Indian and the U.S. governments? And secondly, thank you.
My name is Deepal. I'm from Elliott School. And my question is about interoperability agreements that you were mentioning. With the weapons purchases by India and the issues of SISMOR or LSA coming up, how do you see this going forward?
I'm Manohar Thiagaraj. I have my own business advisory practice in the U.S.-India defense relationship. If I may ask two questions, or you can cut me off at one, but the first relates to the end states. Amir, I'm taken by your mention of defining end states. And I see that the executive, in my opinion, in India is getting weaker by the minute. So could we in the U.S. live with a relationship where the end state is never gotten to, but it's just in waiting? It's just something that's defined but is never gotten to. Is that an acceptable end state? And the second question is for Admiral Dorn. Tri-Service Command, obviously India is trying to stand up Tri-Service Commands, but you interacted with a system where Tri-Service Commands don't exist. They still don't. So is there some learning that the U.S. could impart to India in the standing up of Tri-Service Commands? How would that affect the military engagement?
Let me just very quickly answer a few of the parts that I think are relevant to my expertise, and then we'll move on. The transits of the Malacca Strait, of course, were key, critical, okay, and they were unique when they occurred. They showed it can be done. I think both naval services benefited from it, and there was a certain degree of camaraderie that built up between the people that were involved in those. A lot of it around Singapore, some of it over in the Andamans. But, yes, that was a very important thing and should not be forgotten and hopefully could be built upon. Although, remember, that was an extraordinary set of circumstances that pushed that together, okay? On the Tri-Service Command, we do talk to the Indian military about joint work. One of the things we realize is that joint is hard for the United States. Joint is very easy to talk about and very hard to do for everybody, and that's a dialogue that we should be having. We were having it with the Japanese as a result of Fukushima and the Tomodachi operation up in Japan afterwards, the importance of joint operations. But again, you get to an internal point where if you're going to have a joint service command, the stovepipes within which the individual services live in have to be broken down in India first. They have to agree to being joint before you can go joint. The question on the weapons purchases and the SISMOA, and I think you mentioned EUM and pieces like that, are very important. They are also extremely clear examples of places where things should be changed on both sides, okay, and where words mean different things on both sides, and it gets very complicated talking to the Indian customer, in this case, about what end-use monitoring really means and why we don't think it's intrusive and they think it's terribly intrusive and where it goes from there. Those are key issues that have to be worked at. And I'll leave it at that. I can talk at more length afterwards.
Just real quick, on the Special Forces question, we did address in the full report the issue of Special Forces engagement. The key challenge in the Special Forces realm has been that, you know, after the Mumbai attacks, in trying to build up India's counterterrorism capabilities. I mean, you have to understand that terrorism is an inherently law enforcement function within India. And so, as such, it's not the Ministry of Defense that has authorities over that particular mission area. It is the Ministry of Home Affairs. And even then, what also makes it even more complicated is, of course, the states themselves actually take the lead on a lot of these law enforcement functions. So the Defense Department, which has a tremendous amount of capacity on counterterrorism and has a lot to offer, finds itself in a very difficult position in engaging the Indian establishment because of the bureaucratic sort of stovepiping that goes on with regard to MHA not really or kind of resisting sort of special forces engagement. My understanding is that it's getting marginally better. I think that there have been some exchanges or some subject matter exchanges between the National Security Guards and the Indian and the American Special Forces. But in terms of building CT capacity, it's been a little bit limited. The other component to this, of course, is just dealing with the special forces across all the Indian armed services. So the special forces do deal with the Air Force, the Navy, and the Army special forces, which is a helpful sort of an engagement. I think it's helpful to build up their capacity in that regard. But when we talk counterterrorism, it's naturally quite limited. To the question of defining end states, can we live without end states? I think absolutely we could. But I make the recommendation in the report because, engaging for the sake of engaging, I think, it's good to have that sort of optic of the two militaries working together, but it really kind of helps you to focus the sorts of engagements and, more importantly, the sorts of capabilities that you want to develop if you've got a sort of a common end state towards which you're working. And so that's why we, to that end, made that recommendation.
Secretary Panetta appointed Deputy Secretary Ash Carter to take over the portfolio to cut through the bureaucratic red tape in defense trade. So we're hoping for similar attention in the rest. I should also mention that we have distributed this report to a number of people that are quite familiar with these topics, including Admiral Keating. And I'm looking at his email, which said, after he reviewed it, he said, this is a comprehensive, rational, logical document. I think that ought to be the blurb on the dust jacket. But he also said increased emphasis on information sharing and intelligence sharing should be there. And in terms of the end state, which Mira just referred to, we talked to General Chip Grayson, who said the recommendation to work towards some realistic understanding of the nature of our goals is very important, especially for the U.S., and then he said, and I think this is where we'll end it before I turn to Amir for a final comment. He said, this is a unique situation with a very unique country, and we need a unique approach. So we will be working toward that end. Amir, final comment before we all thank you and the Admiral.
Just to say, there's a couple of more folks that I'd like to acknowledge. I mean, with any of these reports at CSIS, it's always a team effort. And so there's a few members of the team that I do want to recognize. Nick Lombardo, who's our program coordinator and research assistant for the Wadhwani chair, has been instrumental in helping to orchestrate a lot of the research assistance. Justin Painter, an intern with the program. Justin, raise your hand there. He's been wonderful in helping to put together the report. Sumir Punyani, also an intern with our program as well, and then Niraj Patel, who's not here with us today, but it was also truly a team effort, and I want to thank all of them as well, which was. And then finally, I'd like to thank General Dynamics for making this report or these reports possible. Thank you.
Before we end and give our speakers a round of applause, we do want to give. Admiral Doran, a little gift of appreciation. Now, we normally do coffee mugs or umbrellas, but I was in Annapolis recently, and I saw a T-shirt, which I thought would be perfect for the occasion, and I hope I get this right. This is a T-shirt from Annapolis, which has U.S. Navy Annapolis and an aircraft carrier
steaming toward you saying 90,000 tons of diplomacy. As a former diplomat, I would like to give it to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much. Get that?
Yeah, this is, I love this. Hopefully it's not too off politically correct, I don't know. But I mentioned to you that this is a bittersweet occasion because this is our last occasion with Amir with us. And we thought that when he returns to the Pentagon for that D-ring office that I'm sure he will be occupying, we thought we should give him something to hang up, which is a super enlarged version of the report. So, Amir, thank you for
thank
everything.
You.
Let's get this here. We can, right? Here we go. And finally, clearly, a final applause for our wonderful speakers. Thank you all for being here. Okay.